Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Riff Hard Podcast, the best podcast in the world for everything about metal guitar. Our guest today is Chase Wilson, guitarist from the band Of Sulfur. Now, Of Sulfur is a band that has recently started to gain a lot of recognition in the metal world. They just put out an album called Burden of Faith in March of 2023. I think that they're a band that really understands how to be a band. And I've been very, very impressed watching their rise. And what I think is cool about this episode is talking to Chase about everything that goes into just getting exactly the kind of sound that you're going for on the guitar, which is actually harder and less intuitive than you would expect because, I mean, look, let's face it. So many people want something with guitar, but can't accomplish it. But Chase is very clear in how he developed exactly what a sound is, and let's get into it. Chase Wilson, welcome to the Riff Hard Podcast.
Hey, thank you so much. I'm stoked you guys have me on. So it's a pleasure.
Likewise. Like I told you before we started, I'm a fan of what you guys do. It's always cool to me when I see a band that both sounds fresh and also like takes the whole package seriously. It's refreshing.
Thank you, man. That really means a lot. We're doing a little bit of different stuff, so it's not everyone's cup of tea, but I'm glad it's yours for sure. And you know, we're always trying to do something a little bit different outside the box. So that means a lot coming from you.
Is that something that the whole visual side of it, is it something that developed organically, or was it there from the get-go? Like, we're going to do this band that's like devastatingly evil and heavy, and there's going to be imagery that matches it.
That kind of happened organically, to be totally honest. We really love what MM Customs has done with the imagery of the album rollout, everything from like the videos to the album cover and, you know, anything in between. Missy and Vicente just absolutely nailed it. And Ricky was actually a fan of hers before even doing the band, and he knew he wanted her involved somehow. So it just kind of worked out, and you know, she's been awesome. So I'm really grateful to be able to have such an awesome artist do pretty much the entire album rollout with us.
It helps to have everything be cohesive. It really does.
Oh, 110%.
Well, not all musicians think about that stuff. Therefore, not all bands think about that stuff. And then I think lots of the time, it's almost like an afterthought. It's thrown together at the last minute. And I don't mean that I think that every band needs to have some over-the-top visual imagery. Because like, if you look at some bands like Opeth, like it's very simple imagery, but it's appropriate to what they sound like. I think that that's what matters, is that what you're seeing and what you're hearing is congruent.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, it was like we were just kind of, when we first started getting up on stage, and you know, we would have t-shirts and jeans and like just look like normal dudes up on stage, and we were just like stoked to be doing a band like this. And then once we started to get into the album cycle and we signed, and you know, things started getting a little bit more real, I was like, we should definitely do something different than just the t-shirt and jeans type deal. We should definitely take more consideration into music videos and how things look. And the rest of the guys agreed, and that's how we have the look that we do now. It's more so like when you're putting on a show, it's like it's visually pleasing to look at live, it's visually pleasing to look at on video. It's almost like a uniform or a stage clothes or whatever, however you want to view it. But it's like it does make a huge difference.
Funny to call this stuff visually pleasing, but I agree with you.
Visually pleasing to me.
Yeah, it's funny what the aesthetic is for all things metal, because so much of it is the exact opposite of what a lot of people would consider to be visually pleasing.
Totally.
I don't know. I like it.
Thanks, man. I mean, me and Ricky are huge like horror nerds too, so anything with gore, like blood and monsters and whatever, like, you know, we're all about. So when we had the chance to put that in our music videos, Ricky's never done that before. Everybody has seen the Suffocate video where he comes up out of the lake and then they're playing in a barn, you know. It's a lot different. Yeah. A lot different from that.
And the coming out of the water scene is it's a classic scene.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
Yeah. I feel like even if people don't know who Suffocate is, everybody knows that scene.
Oh, 110%. I feel like that has to be on like some kind of YouTube compilation somewhere of like early 2000s metalcore, deathcore. Yeah, totally. That's funny.
So you worked with Mike Montoya, aka Morgoth Beats. I've actually known him for a really, really long time because I recorded Goliath, his old band, back in like 2014. And it's been really, really cool to watch him go from, I don't want to say slumming it, but like having a hard time in a van doing that whole life to now the kind of stuff that he's working on, working with all these sick high profile artists, just doing cool project after cool project after cool project. What were you hoping for when you guys decided to bring him on board?
So when we signed with Century Media, we had like a couple producers like that we were thinking of and stuff. Our guy Gitter, Mike Gitter, shout out to him.
Good old Gitter. Shout out Mike. I like him a lot, by the way.
Oh, dude, Gitter's the shit. I love that guy, man. Like, honestly, and for him to, he's put in a lot of work and he's put up with us, which is a lot. So, I mean, he's a great guy, man. I don't know what we'd do without him. He was actually the one who brought up, he's like, what about Morgoth Beats? And I was like, he's the guitar player for Winds of Plague. And he goes, yeah. I was like,
yep,
that actually works out. Cause I mean, they were doing it well before we were. Them and Bleeding Through are like the OGs of like this style of music, you know? And I thought it would be a good mix, especially since he's like doing pop now with like Machine Gun Kelly and Juice WRLD and like all these other artists. It might be a different take, which I write in pop structure, so it kind of did work out perfectly. So, I mean, we pretty much got exactly what we wanted out of it, which was his kind of pop influence as well as his, you know, metal influence. It was great.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. My band Doth, that just put out a single, we just recorded a bunch of stuff. We chose Andrew Wade to produce the vocals, and I chose him specifically because, like, his vocal everything with production comes from pop. And he works with a lot of like pop punk bands and some heavier bands. He's not known for extreme metal, but I know he can do heavy because I've heard it. The fact that he knows how to think in terms of catchy and pop is actually kind of rare, the heavy music scene. There's a lot of people that are super competent at producing extreme music, but to marry a pop structure, I don't mean like marry pop music, but marry pop structure with catchy elements to music that's really extreme is actually, it's actually kind of rare.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of how I've been writing since I started playing music, you know, and it just stuck. And it was really, I mean, it's like you said, it's very rare in this type of music because most of the time you kind of get like the riff salad is like what I call it, or, you know, you get people who want to shred over everything, and which is fine. And that's cool for like some bands, and like it works for a lot of bands. But what makes sense to me is having that, okay, this is the intro, this is the verse, this is the pre-chorus, this is the chorus. In the chorus, there's going to be a vocal hook, you know, like that just, it just makes sense. And you know, it just sticks in people's heads easier, in my personal opinion. You know, you're going to remember the chorus you hear four times than, you know, a riff that might be played or something like that, you know?
Yeah. It's almost like for a riff to be remembered, it needs to be almost treated like a hook or a chorus.
Absolutely. I 110% agree with that. You know,
actually I think that riffs and metal are like, not entirely, but they are like another version of the hook in a song.
Oh yeah.
A properly done riff.
You know, I mean, it's like sometimes like, you know, every instrument has its part in a hook, including vocals. And, you know, even a soul, like a lead or something like that can like be remembered if it's like simple enough, if it has that catchy melody to it. And, you know, I just feel like, you know, everything's important. And, you know, sometimes the vocals take precedence over a lot of things, but everything has their part to play. And if you get just the right amount of everything in there, you kind of have your perfect song, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that even though you can probably name a handful of artists that are able to do that all themselves without a producer. It's like such a fine balance of all the elements happening in the arrangement and the writing at the same time that it really helps to have someone on the team on board who that's their entire job. Because I think that if you're the songwriter and an instrumentalist, you kind of have your hands full with that. Just that alone is a shitload of stuff. It really helps to have a producer who I don't want to say does it for you, because that's not what I think it is. It's more just helps fine tune it into that.
Yeah, it's almost like somebody to help you balance yourself. You know what I mean? It's a collaborative thing. And I actually prefer that setting in writing music, is someone there to be like, that's cool, but could we do this? Or that's cool, could we do this? And I'm, you know, when I'm writing with the other guys, that's exactly how it is too. I'm like, that's cool, but what if we made it like this? Or what if we did it like this? You know, somebody to always check you is so good to have when you're writing music. It's not like, not only a producer sense, but even if it's like another guitar player or the bass player that's helping you write riffs or whoever it might be, you know, like having that second person is always just essential in my opinion.
I definitely know that I've always written better when I have a sounding board, for sure.
Totally.
It's too easy to kind of just get wrapped up in your own shit if you're doing it on your own and lose objectivity quickly.
Totally. And like, yeah, I mean, ego does play a part in writing music, and you might think it's like the shit, and then somebody else comes along, it's like, no, it's not the shit, it is shit. So it's like, you know,
some sort of shit.
Yeah, some sort of shit. Exactly. It's good to have somebody like that checks you, yeah, because then that's how you become a better musician. If I didn't have Matt to check me during the writing of this album, then I don't know where we'd be. He made me a better player because of it too.
Well, it's an interesting thing that you said about ego, because it's like you need to have enough ego to feel confident in pursuing an idea and actually showing it to somebody. Like that in and of itself, like you got to feel like what you're doing is valuable enough to even bring to the table. And that takes some ego, and you have to feel like it's strong enough to actually put yourself out there, even beyond the people in your circle. Like you have to have some level of ego to be able to deal with that. But then you can't have so much that you're basically getting high on your own farts or something. Basically.
Basically. That's such a good way to put it. It's like, it reminds me of that South Park episode.
Yeah, you got to control the fart huffing, basically. It's musical fart huffing. I find that having other people in there really helps, because otherwise, like, how do you really know?
Yeah. You don't. That's the thing. And it's like, you know, I know what I do is like good, and I know that people will enjoy it. And you know, but that's not to say the first thing I write is going to be like perfect. And I know that. And if that person's not there to check me on it, and I put it out, and then it's like, dude, you could have done better. I'm like, yeah, well, you know. So it's like,
you're right.
Yeah. And then I'm like, yeah, you might be right. Yeah. I'm never, you know, too proud to say that I'm wrong. So.
So the first thing you write, man, I feel like that right there is one of the biggest mistakes I see unsigned bands making. And the reason I say unsigned bands is because once a band is signed, the budget goes up and they can work with the producer. Like shit gets more serious, and like the level of scrutiny goes up because it has to. So there's obviously unsigned bands who are good about this and they typically end up moving on. But what I've noticed with a lot of bands that never move forward is there's a few things that they're doing. But one thing that, like, I have just seen this throughout my entire career is sticking with the first thing you write and not opening it up to scrutiny. Not just sticking with the first thing you write, like, in general, but, like, in terms of chronologically in the song, it's like, the first thing I wrote for the song becomes the intro. The second thing becomes the verse, etc. And whatever order you write it in becomes the order that it appears in the song. Not just the order, but like the version you wrote it, like that first version is the version. That shit's crazy to me, but I feel like not then putting it through any scrutiny or quality control and then refining and ditching and making more. I feel like that's where a lot of bands that aren't as far along in their careers is one of the places where they go wrong.
Yeah, that and having the sense that the music they write is infallible. You know, like that's a huge thing with a lot of local bands I was in or was around and stuff like that, where, you know, somebody in the band was like, no, that's great, I wrote it and it's fine. It's like, you know, sometimes it's not fine. So
no, and you need to be ready to let it go.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, it's like you said, you got to have enough ego to put it out there and, like, you know, show it to people, but then you also got to have enough common sense to know when you're wrong, or, you know, common sense to know, like, that somebody's giving you good constructive criticism. And that's where most musicians that are, I feel like, successful kind of find their balance. It's knowing you're good enough to do what you do, and then knowing your own ability to be checked and maybe do something else or push you forward. You know, like that's where a lot of people, it's kind of like make or break almost.
All the best, like, for instance, all the best guitar players I know still actively seek lessons. And I'm talking about, like, some of the best people on the planet who a lot of people would say they don't need lessons. Like, why would Jeff Loomis need guitar lessons? But that's why he's so good. Yeah. Is because he keeps on getting guitar lessons.
Yeah, man. I mean, like, there was a point in time when I was a kid where my uncle played in Marilyn Manson. He now plays for Rob Zombie. And there was a point where he had told us, like, he's like, oh yeah, I'm having a lesson. I'm like you're getting a lesson? Like, he's like, yeah, I can do this and that. And I'm like, why? I was like, because to me, he's the greatest drummer on earth. And, like, you know, like, I'm 9 years old. I'm like, why? It's like, you know, but I remember him saying that. And I'm like, that blew my mind.
There's a correlation there, though, between the fact that he has done great and he's also pushed himself to keep on getting better.
Yeah, 110%. To play in a band like he's playing in now is, like, you know, that's like the dream for most people, and he's doing it. So it's like, he didn't do it just by, you know, sliding by. He did it because he wants to get better at his craft.
Yeah, totally. And I think that, like we said before, it's just so hard to do that without getting outside input, because not even ego. Sometimes it's just our brain stops hearing things accurately. Like, I know that in mixing, you know, you have X amount of time before your ears change the way they hear things, and they'll adapt to what you're hearing. So if you're, you know, mixing guitars and there's all kinds of weird high end, if you sit there long enough, you're not going to hear it right anymore. They'll just adapt. They'll, like, EQ it for you, and you're not going to be hearing what's actually there. And I think that when you're working on a song, you can do the same thing. Like, that's, you've heard it so many times that way that your brain has just adjusted to think that's how it goes. And it lots of times takes somebody else to say, I don't know, maybe that shouldn't be the way it goes.
Yeah, totally. It's like, you know, you hear for something for so long and that's the way you hear it. And sometimes, like, you're so used to hearing something like that, it's just common, and you're like, oh, that's fine. That's fine. And somebody else, like you said, somebody else will come along, be like, you know, no, that's, it's always good to have checks and balances. Always good to have checks and balances in your team, no matter where that might be, whether it's a band member, producer, guitar teacher, you know, like anything like that, that, you know, you can correct those mistakes and move on from it and you just get better at what you do.
Do you write stuff for the band on your own, or is it strictly collaborative?
I do both. There's only been, like, one song that was pretty much, like, untouched, even after the production aspect. I mean, untouched is, I say that loosely, because it was definitely touched a little bit. But Earthen is the first thing I wrote for the album. I wrote it in my house by myself after a tour we were just on. I was, like, inspired to write because we went on tour with Signs of the Swarm and Worm Shepherd, who are insane bands. And we had released the Oblivion EP. And I was like, I wonder what I can do, like, different, like something similar to, like, what these guys are doing, but not quite. And, like, I wrote Earthen in its entirety. And I think the only thing that we did different was maybe chopped up the breakdown in the middle and added the breakdown at the end. Everything else is like pretty much exactly how I wrote it. So that was the one instance where that actually worked. Everything else was pretty collaborative.
But you know, it's important to recognize when you do pull that off to not just cut it up because you think you should.
Yeah, totally.
That's also tough to recognize, is like, this is actually should not be fucked with too much.
Well, yeah. And it was kind of like an ego boost for me because it was like, damn, I wrote this all by myself. All right. But, you know, it was kind of almost like validating. But at the same time, you know, it surprised me too because it was the first thing I wrote for the record. I would expect it to be that's the thing that gets changed the most, you know, like that's usually how it works out.
Yeah, totally. Just out of curiosity. And obviously, there's no way to have like an actual number on this, but what percentage of the stuff that you or you guys write gets cut or changed, roughly speaking?
Listening to the demos and then the Morgoth versions and then the full mixed and master versions, I have like three different versions of them, you know? I would say like, you know, things that got changed immensely, not much. I would say like, to put a percentage on it, it's so tough. I would say maybe like 30% of it, 20 to 30% of it got changed, maybe. You know, Morgoth did his thing, and there were some songs like where, for example, I would have orchestral ideas and he would, you know, take pretty much what I did and expand on it. I had no songs with orchestrals and he got to do whatever the hell he wanted on it. So it's kind of hard to say, but to be fair, there was a good chunk of work done on it. So I'd say maybe like 35%, maybe.
The reason I'm asking is just because kind of like continuation of us talking about getting checked or whatever, is I think that it's important to go into a session or any situation like this with a band where you just accept the fact that a certain percentage of what you wrote for it might be gone forever, or might be changed to something unrecognizable, or it might not, but it might happen and that's okay. That's part of it.
Yeah, totally. I mean, going into it, we knew these songs could sound totally different, you know, going into the studio with, we actually had three producers on this record. We had Logan, who tracked guitars. We had Morgoth, who tracked vocals and did the orchestrals and kind of did overall production. And then Josh Schrader mixed and mastered it. And each of them kind of like did their own thing in their own respective way, you know? So, I mean, it's one of those things. We knew that it was probably going to sound different from what we wrote. And like, we knew that all the bells and whistles were going to get added like afterwards, you know, like, you know, drops and dramatic pauses and stuff like that, you know. But yeah, I mean, it's one of those things, like, you can't go into the studio and expect it to be the same thing when you come out. That would just be asinine, because you're going in there to have somebody produce you, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why I think that the more you write, the easier it is to do that, because I feel like if you write a lot, your personal attachment to everything is going to go down because you have so many other ideas and you're capable of just, that doesn't work. All right, come up with this. That doesn't work. Okay, try this. As opposed to not writing very much, then every idea that gets cut has that much more meaning. And it's like, I guess, the opposite of validating.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, I always tell my guys this too, because, you know, some might know, some might not know. It's like, don't be married to an idea, because that idea might not be there when you get out of the studio. Like, it just might not be. You might think it's the coolest thing in the world, and then somebody could tell you, like, it's not going to make the record. And that's just how it is. And you shouldn't be married to anything that goes on these songs. That's like the ego thing I mentioned earlier. It's like, know that you're good enough to do what you do, but also know your own ability and what we're doing to make these songs better, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Just out of curiosity also, how do you go about preparing for the studio guitar-wise? Because if you know that things might change and you practice thing it one way, knowing that that might not be the way it actually ends up, are you wasting your time practicing it that way? And therefore, like, how do you go about preparing for the studio? Just as a player.
No, I don't think it's a waste of time to learn it how you wrote it, because, you know, you don't know what's going to get cut, you know, like, so I feel like to practice those songs to the best of your ability so you can play them in the studio perfectly is a great tool. And pretty much how I prepare for that is I look in the mirror and I just tell myself, hey, don't suck. And then I go and do it.
If only it were that easy. Don't fuck this up.
Yeah. You have one shot. Do not fuck this up, Chase.
Just don't.
But yeah, I mean, no, a lot of practicing does go into it. And like, you know, it's funny because Matt, our former guitar player, was like kind of stressing. And he was like, oh my God, we have so much to do. We have this, that, the other thing. And then when we get into the studio and we start with Logan, he's like, oh man, this is nice. He's like, actually, this is going way better than I thought it would. I was like, yeah, bro, I told you to relax. I mean, it's like, it's not the end of the world. Like you have to practice and like make sure you're good. But I think what, you know, he got in his own head and like, I actually got in my own head as well. Cause he started to get into my head like, oh man, I'm not prepared. I'm not this and I'm not that. And like, of course we're prepared. We've been practicing. We've had the songs written. We have a good map of what we're doing in the studio. You know, it's like sometimes like getting in your own head, like that's not necessary, you know, but we did it, we tracked it. And the album, in my opinion, I think it's really good. So
sounds awesome. One thing that I always do getting in my own head wise is it's almost like, even though intellectually I know it's going to be fine and practiced really hard, ready, my brain, the fight or flight part of it, is like treating it as though there's no such thing as punching in and that you only get one take at it. So you better be fucking perfect, but that's just not reality. Like, it's not to say that you should go in and fake it, but like you do get more than one take. You can sit there and work on it. So as long as you know it pretty damn well, it'll be okay. But still, like, I'll still get in my own head and like, I will feel like I only have one take to do this in. And there's nothing I can tell myself that changes that feeling, except for just going to the studio and kind of getting through a song and then chill out.
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, the best way to relieve that stress is to just get in there and do it. Like I'm a huge Star Wars nerd and I'm always like, there is no try. There's only do. So you just go in there and do it.
You can't simulate it either. That's the thing. It's like, it's the same with like playing live. You can practice all you want and have as much rehearsal as you want, and you should have a lot, but there's no amount that you can rehearse that will prepare you for the adrenaline surge you get playing live and then dealing with that while playing. Nothing will get you ready besides actually doing that.
I agree 110%. Like, and like sometimes, you know, like you'll get on stage and stuff like that and it'll almost feel like slow motion, like, which mm-hmm. is why I'm grateful we play to a click. But, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, you know, we did the Lorna tour and those rooms were huge. And it's like the first time a lot of us have ever done anything like that. And it was like, fuck, man, that's a lot of people. And you know, but you get up there and you do it and like, you know, that's the only way I can describe it. You just have to get up there and do it. And like, it's a crazy feeling, but sometimes, you just have to, I don't know. It sounds insensitive to just say, get over it, but it's kind of what you have to do.
No. Yeah. Well, I mean, what else are you going to do, man? That first time you see a lot of people when you haven't done that before, it's cool. It's very cool, but it's not as one-sided as just being awesome. Like I don't want to say terrifying, but it's like a reality check when you know when it's like right before that and it's like, oh, fuck. That is a shitload of people.
Yeah, 100%. And it is terrifying.
Don't fuck this up. Yeah, it can be.
Yeah, man. I mean, to say it's not would be like, you'd be lying. Like it is, especially if you've never done something like that before. I mean, you know, we're still a very young band and it's like, I've been in band since I was like 15, 16, and you still kind of don't get over it. It's kind of like mind blowing. So in a very good way, but yeah.
I heard that Tom Mariah, I don't know if he stopped this, but I heard that for a long time into Slayer's career, he would still puke before shows, long into them being a huge band.
I heard that as well.
He would still get the butterflies and puke.
I don't puke. First off, let me just say that I don't puke.
I don't either.
But sometimes I will, like, you know, I'll get the butterflies, or like I'll like get, you know, like not the jitters per se, but like my body like will tingle and stuff like that. And I'm like, oh, here we go. It's time to go. And I kind of just, you know, shake it out, jump around, do what I got to do and do my thing. I've never talked with anybody else who's done this like this before. I've never really asked my uncle, like, hey, do you get nervous when you play for fucking millions of people? Like, you know, I don't ask those questions because I feel like it's a silly question, but you know, who knows? There might be a lot of people that still get it and whatever. And like you said, I have heard the Tom Araya story and it's crazy because he was a massive band, you know?
Yeah. I don't think it's silly. I think it's, for me, it's interesting from the perspective of what a human is capable of doing under stress. So, because like you hear about this with soldiers or cops a lot, like people who have to like do technical things that are difficult and require a lot of precision, like shooting. One thing is targets. Another thing is when there's a situation that you weren't expecting, that's just evolving in real time and you're going to die. And then they say that your motor skills decrease by about like 40%. And obviously it's not the same as going on stage. Going on stage, you're not going to die, but our fight or flight response doesn't know the difference. And so our motor skills do decrease when we have that. And so you have to learn how to play the music under that state. So for me, it's interesting if people who have been doing it for a long time and who are in huge bands, if they still get that, or if they like are so seasoned and so used to it that it doesn't faze them. And if it does faze them, how do they deal with it? Because obviously they deal with it.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's like you said, I mean, you can't just not, it's you either do it or you don't.
You have
to. Yeah. Yeah. But there are some people that probably would never tell you if they do or not, you know? So
yeah, true.
Hard to say.
Yeah, I've noticed that one thing that would happen to me is the biggest mistake would be to get to think about it too much.
Yeah.
Basically, like because I've noticed that if I start to think about it too much while in that state of mind, that's when I like forget what's coming up next and start mentally tripping up. But if you can just like go with it and then trust that practiced enough, usually would go fine.
Totally. Yeah. Once you get in your own head about it, that's when you start to make like the big mistakes, I feel like, you know, because I've been there, I've done it. And it's not fun, but you learn from it. So when you can realize it's there and kind of overcome it and just be like, I'm going to do this fucking show, like, or, you know, whatever. It's like when you can start to ignore it is when it's, when you kind of like feel the most powerful and you get that high on stage, and it's a good feeling when you can start to ignore it.
So speaking of getting ready for tour and also getting ready for recording, is there any sort of guitar routine or type of thing that you focus on or like that you make yourself do, just like technically speaking?
Yeah. I mean, if you couldn't tell, I'm like a huge gallop guy. So I always do my gallop exercises, alternate picking exercises. I'm more on the rhythm side of things. I'm by no means a technical guitar player at all. So it's like, I don't do sweep picking routines. I don't do any of that stuff or anything.
I think rhythm is like very technical.
Really?
To me. Cause it's like, it's a different kind of technical, right? It's not like sweeping is its own thing, but like, even like simple riffs, the proof that it's a technical thing too is just go watch a local band, try to do the style of music that some other band is famous for. And people who would say that, like, you know, playing like Korn riffs is easy, maybe on the surface they're easy, but back in the day, if you would go watch local bands that were trying to be Korn and they sounded like fucking garbage, and then you hear Korn, and it's like the most devastating thing you've ever heard, and the riffs sound amazing. Well, obviously they're doing something different on guitar. So like how you're muting it, how you're picking it, like your timing, like all that stuff, it's all technical, in my opinion.
Well, there I would agree with you for sure. When it comes down to rhythm technique, that is kind of where it gets a lot more technical.
And I was picking out Korn because like the riffs aren't complex.
Totally. Yeah.
But they're amazing.
Korn is one of the greatest bands of all time.
Oh yeah, for sure.
it's like a huge influence for me, especially like, you know, being a younger kid and, you know, seeing them play that type of stuff. That was probably like heaviest band of their day.
Pulverizing.
Absolutely. And some of the first, well, I don't know about the first, but some of the first main kind of like mainstream rock bands to use like 7-string guitars and stuff like that. So I was, you know, which is where I, you know, I love baritone 7-string guitars, and I love that low sound, and I love making crushing tones. Like, that's just my jam. If I can like pulverize you with like open notes all the time and just play the open notes differently, then I'll do it. You know, it's one of those things.
Okay. So that play the open notes differently. What do you mean?
Well, it's like you said, like kind of like the attack on the picking, or, you know, muting in specific places, or, you know, letting it ring, or, you know, whatever you're doing it with it, you know, like there are so many different ways you can play open notes that sound awesome. And it's, I guess that's, it's really all just in like the technique of how you play it. You know, like I know people joke about it, and it's not really true to these days because Josh Travis is amazing, but Emir, like some of the early records,
God,
zeros and ones, bro. It's like, it's so, but it's so good. It's so good.
Yes.
Yeah. That's the prime example. Like those dudes were just really good at playing zeros and ones really differently. It's fucking great,
man. I remember back, like some of our first tours, like I remember one of the first real ones was with Acacia Strain back in like 07. And I know that they have stuff that's more complicated at times, but they still had a lot of 0-1 riffs. And DL had a stack of crank cabinets.
Hell
like,
yeah.
Yeah, the shit. Yeah. People. And in those days, people made fun of cranks, like, and he had a wall of them, and his tone was better than anybody else's on any tour we ever did with them. It was just like so fucking devastating and
crushing.
Didn't need. Yeah, it was ridiculous. And it was a lot of zeros and ones and gear that was arguably not great, arguably, because it sounded great. And then I've heard Andy Sneap use cranks all the time and they sound great. So arguably great or not great, but like what's not arguable is that the tone was just deadly, and it had to be down to how he played that stuff.
Yeah, man. I mean, I also had a crank, so I loved it.
So you know.
Point, I do know. I had a Rev 1.
Oh yeah, me too.
Oh, see? They're great. I love them. But yeah, I mean, it's just, there's a lot that goes into the rhythm side of things that people would anticipate. Like, is your tone on point? Is your right hand just like a tack machine? Like, you know, the one thing I will like always pride myself is like, I'm super tight when it comes to like triplets or gallops or anything like that, because I've trained my hand in order to do those types of things. It's all in the way you play something. It might not be what you play, it's how you play it.
It's an interesting distinction. I mean, I realize that we're talking about something that probably developed over the span of many, many years. But like, if a guitar student was like, hey, I want to learn how to pick like you, what should I focus on?
I'd probably say, I don't know, man. I just, you know, do it.
I'm sure that like, even if you think you just did it, like there had to be shit that you like did repeatedly.
There is. I'm just joking. I guess the best thing to do is kind of figure out who you want to play like, and learn those songs. Like, the reason I feel like my right hand is as strong as it is because of, you know, listening to Trivium or Killswitch Engage, like, you know, the dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun, you know, stuff like that, or, you know, they were just super solid. And like, I focused more on the rhythms than their solo playing, which a lot of people were, I feel like, opposite with those bands. So pretty much learning songs like that and figuring out what you want to do and doing it in your own way is probably the best way to do that, because that's exactly how I did it.
How would you learn them? Would you just like by ear or tabs or videos or
kind of a mix? I'm all self-taught. So like when it comes to theory, it's like out the window, you know, like, because I can tell you if something sounds good, I'll be honest.
I mean, that's what matters.
Yeah. I just, you know, I can't tell you what mode it's in. I can't tell you what key it's in or anything like that.
Doesn't fucking matter. It matters. But like the thing is that I've noticed this from a lot of my friends that I consider to be really good musicians or guitar players that are in really good bands who don't know theory, mm-hmm. is they say they don't know theory. And what I think what they really mean is they don't know the academic names for shit,
yeah.
but their ears are so good that they are they're just naturally doing all that stuff. Maybe with a little bit of like their own stuff that maybe on a test at a school would get them a bad grade, but that just sounds cool. But their ears are so developed that they've got all that shit in them. They just don't use the names that appear in a textbook for it.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And that's like, you know, why I feel like if you really want to get into playing, like play other people's songs and kind of like just figure out a style that you really enjoy playing, whether it be something like Acacia Strain or something like Trivium or something like, you know, Bullet for My Valentine or whatever you like, you know, I'm just saying bands that I liked as a kid. Mm-hmm. So, you know, whether it be one of those bands, you know, like, and take the best out of all of them and kind of utilize it in your music. That's the best way to kind of like learn to do anything. Like, you know, when I heard JFC from Acacia Strain, where it's that dun 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 dun, like, I was like, damn, that's sick. And it's like, I was like, I want to learn how to play like that. I want to, like, you know, gallop, or I want to, you know, do those types of things. That's the best way to do it. And like, I learned through tabs. I'd learned some by ear, and like then I probably find out that the stuff I learned from ear was wrong, so I went back to tabs, you know, like a mix of doing everything. And trial and error is kind of like the best way to better yourself as a musician. And I guess that the next piece of advice would always be to always surround yourself with other good musicians so you can kind of learn from them as well. It's like being an apprentice in a tattoo shop. If you're just tattooing like at home when nobody's there to check you, you'll be like a great kitchen wizard, but you're not going to be a great tattoo artist, you know.
That's a good way to, yeah, it's, man, that is a great piece of advice. That always has been my actually approach in the band, is to try to be the worst player.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, just try to be the worst player. Also try to be awesome. But like, if I'm the worst player, it means that like there's always someone on my team that can help me get better. You know, having people around you that are better than you at certain things, like you got to be able to hold your own at what you bring to the table. But working with people who can help you get better, like you rise to the level or sink to the level of the people you surround yourself with.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I know I said it earlier, but like having somebody like our former guitar player, Matt Jans, who helped write the record, he made me kind of think of riffs in a different way. I'm used to the Acacia Strain type stuff, because I was playing that stuff before I was playing this, you know. Like, I'm not, like, when he wrote Befouler, I had to learn Befouler, and I was stressing because I was like, I don't know if I can, maybe I can play it. And I played it, and I was like, I learned it in like 30 minutes, and I was like, damn, maybe I should just stop like doubting myself, because I can play the stuff. It's one of those things where I always get in my own head, or I have imposter syndrome, like, man, I don't deserve these things, or like, I'm not good, or I'm not this. But you've been playing since you were like 10 years old. Like, you do know how to play. You do deserve these things. You write music, you know, that's being listened to by tons of people. It's one of those things where it's like, a lot of people will also get in their own head and think something's not good enough and not want to release or anything like that. But Matt made me a better player. Really, what it is like, Matt made me realize that I can play these things. Like, and that I don't suck. And that, you know, like, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not just, you know, the chug guy. Like, I can do these things.
First of all, if you were just a chug guy, not that many people are good at sounding good on those. Like, it's one of those things where like people joke about the 010, but like, try doing it. It's very hard to actually sound the way that like the way that those bands that are sick at it sound, that's not easy.
Yeah.
It doesn't just happen. And the thing with imposter syndrome, man, is it's a weird thing because I've also had that, like, stressing about something and then just knock it out. It's like, what the fuck was wrong with me? There's a,
yeah,
in the new song we just put out, there's this Baroque section that's like based on this Bach piece. It was a fucking nightmare because just learning it and writing it is just, I built it up into this like mountain and it is very difficult. I was stressed so hard. And then when it came time to record it, like recorded it in like 45 minutes and was like, what the fuck is wrong with me?
Yep.
Then I wonder, did I get it done in 45 minutes because I stressed so hard about it? And so then I don't know, is the imposter syndrome maybe a good thing to a degree because it pushes you to work hard?
Yeah, no, 100%. And like, kind of like I always say, diamonds are made under pressure. That's yeah, kind of my slogan, you know? So I'm always like, my guys will always tell everybody, he stresses like a lot. Like, it's like, I just want it to be good. But you know, it's one of those things where it's like, it's a good thing, but it's also like, I should definitely be more confident in what I do as well. And I'm working harder to each day to kind of like get there, but it can be hard, you know, especially in like a climate where everybody can see your music and you're getting like hate comments and good comments and this and that, and you don't know what to think, you know?
You know what to think. And then also like the very best players in the world are also seeing your stuff.
That also stresses me out.
Yeah, it's like when I'm like, oh man, I know Jason Richardson is going to see this. It's like, fuck.
Yeah, man.
I want to hide. But like the thing too is, I know so many musicians with imposter syndrome and producers too. And the thing that the successful ones have is there's two types. Either one, they're completely narcissistic, like pathologically narcissistic, to where they've got a personality disorder. And that personality disorder, while it is an actual psychological problem, allows them to not question themselves. And that allows them to just have no fear and just go. That, but that's like, that's a very small number of people. I think most of them have a shit ton of imposter syndrome and then just ignore it. They just do the thing anyways. I've noticed through having URM and Riff Hard that a lot of our students, they'll get the imposter syndrome and then not follow through. That's why I try to talk about this on the podcast too with people who are doing it in real life, because it's like, if you hear that like this person who's doing it in real life and is doing sick things also gets imposter syndrome, but they do it anyways, like maybe that's a clue that you should do it anyways too.
Yeah, I would 100% agree with you, because I mean, that's definitely me. Can I kind of just do it?
I mean, why not?
Yeah, dude, what's the worst people can say? You suck. And it's like, okay, well, then I suck. I don't know what to fucking tell you, man. You know?
Like, sorry.
Yeah, sorry, yeah, you don't, you like it.
Play it for me next time on the record and then we'll suck or something. Like,
exactly. So it's like,
I'll send you the tabs. You learn it.
I would rather get out there and hear that and know that I tried to do it versus wondering, what if I did do that? You know, maybe, you know, if I was working at McDonald's like later on and like, damn, I should have really pursued music, you know. I'm not shitting on anybody that works at McDonald's, but you know, it's like one of those things. It's like, you always have that what if you didn't do that thing.
Yeah, totally. And if you do the thing and you get some negative result, negative feedback, or make some mistakes or whatever, get some bad outcomes, well, you have information to like base your next decisions on. You like know shit you can improve on. Whereas if you don't do the thing, it's all in your head. Like, you don't actually know if you suck. You don't actually know if you don't belong, because it's really not up to you to decide that. It's up to everybody else to decide that. So you're kind of, by not doing the thing, you're kind of assuming the decision for everybody else on what the value is of what you do. And it's kind of not your, it's not, you're not the one who can judge that. Just do it.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, you kind of just do it for yourself. Like, you're not mm-hmm. really doing it for anybody else. That's kind of like the mainstay of our band. It's like, we don't have to have clean singing. We don't have to have all these melodic moments in our music. We play deathcore, like, you know, and it's like, we could just not do that stuff, but we want to do that stuff, and we do it for us more so than we do it for anybody else. And if people enjoy it, then that's great. And we're super grateful for any of our like fans or people that listen to our music or whatever. But at the end of the day, you just got to do it for you. Like I said, this is what I wanted to do since I was a little kid. And, you know, I'm always going to try and do better than what I did on the last thing I did, you know? So that's all you can really do. And like, yeah, some of the first bit of music you put out might not be good, but then you do better and then you keep getting better and you just keep doing it until you're in a position where you're confident or you, I mean, whatever.
Or you just keep doing it anyways.
Or you just keep doing it anyway. Yeah, I stopped myself because I was like, man, I just totally fucking contradicted myself.
It's like a forever up and down kind of thing for a musician. Never totally be out of the woods with it, but I still think that like you can let it torture you less.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I agree with that.
This is a good place to end the podcast. I want to thank you very much for taking the time to hang out. It's been an absolute pleasure. And I really, like I said at the beginning, I really do think that your band is sick. So I appreciate it.
Thank you, man. Thank you. And I love what you're doing with Riff Hard and URM. So it's awesome.
Oh, well, thanks.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm honored to be on the show.
Anytime, dude.